CBSI in the World. I'm John Batsu with Anna Borshevskaya. Putin's war in Syria, Russian foreign policy, and the price of America's absence, her new book. It is incredibly deep and careful reporting. I have done what I can in this conversation to touch on revelations that are important to understand where we are now, given that the Kremlin has no intention of leaving Syria. The Kremlin has no intention of leaving the Middle East. This is a battleground with the Western powers, especially with the United States. So Anna comes to the conclusion so far in 2021, 2022, 2023, going forward. The first observation is that the Trump administration was indifferent or uncaring, because the president was, about Syria. Did Putin take advantage of that, Anna, or was that a surprise that the U.S. turned to other concerns during Mr. Trump's time?
There was a difference. There was a slight difference between how Trump himself looked at Syria, and he called it, I think, the land of blood and sand, and how the Syria administration had approached Syria. So there was a bit of tension there. Putin took advantage of perceiving that from a big picture perspective, the United States remains at the very least ambivalent, and is overall looking to shift its priorities when it comes to the Middle East. Under the Trump administration, Assad still remained economically isolated. Unfortunately, the incident where the Turkish offensive was allowed to go forth and the United States abandoned its Syrian Kurdish allies was very much something that that was illustrative of being able to take advantage of American mistakes. And of course, looking forward, we're further seeing continued ambivalence. In fact, we still don't really understand the current White House Syria policy, which is, again, something that Putin is bound to take advantage of.
Yes, you mentioned Turkey. So we'll touch upon that, because you have deep influence, deep reporting about influence in the Kremlin with Turkey. There were incidents, one particular one, a Turkey shoot down of a warplane, an Su-24, that led to what appears to be friction. You also make the case, though, that Russia's surrounding Turkey with naval bases, with military bases. So right now, Mr. Erdogan and Mr. Putin, do they talk regularly? Do they have conversations about the future, or are they reactive only?
No, they continue to hold discussions. Idlib, the issue of Idlib, the Idlib province in Syria remains a thorny problem. You can almost call it a frozen conflict. In fact, I think Syria will ultimately become a frozen conflict that Russia is going to manage. What usually happens, though, is that both Putin and Erdogan compartmentalize their differences, and that's really the key word to describe how Russia handles its diplomacy. They're able to compartmentalize, even as they disagree on some issues. They ultimately are able to discuss and find a solution on issues they disagree with, even if there's not a full resolution. They put a band-aid on it and they still come back to it. And it's an approach that can last for a very long time. It can work for a very long time because of this compartmentalization. And the fact of the matter is, ultimately, despite of so many differences between Russia and Turkey on Syria and on other fronts in the Middle East and in the South Caucasus, their relationship did not burgeon into any kind of confrontation. To the contrary, ultimately, Putin had put a lot of levers of control in place that ultimately found no other way as to this, just to cooperate.
Let's mention three Sunni powers: Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom, Qatar, and Jordan. You make the case, as you have elsewhere, that the Kremlin is successful in neutralizing their opposition to conduct against in Syria by presenting itself as a neutral. Now, the puzzle here is how that matches up with the present aggression by Iran. The Kremlin does the amazing trick of having relations with Tehran at the same time it does it with Riyadh. How do they do this?
Well, it's a very delicate balancing act. The fact of the matter is, it's one thing to portray yourself as neutral, but they're not really neutral. If anything, Russia ultimately has leaned closer in the Middle East to the Iran, Hezbollah, and Assad sort of axis. Even in the Iranian nuclear negotiations, Russia tends to emphasize Iranian points. They almost, as somebody who was involved in these negotiations years ago, said that even in the past, Russia would tend to act as Iran's lawyer. The fact of the matter is, it's a balancing act, and it doesn't mean it's not risky. But so far, it has worked, and in part, perhaps because the region is seeing Russia's ascendance at a time when the United States is signaling ambivalence, This ambivalence has been going on for over a decade now. This is now we're on a third administration that is shifting towards the Asia Pacific. The region sees that Russia is there to stay, and it does what it says it was going to do. They said they would save Assad, and they did. And so everybody sees Russia as an intermediary. And that goes back to a fundamentally different approach that Putin took towards the region that the Soviet Union did.
You make the case that Assad, because Russia does not see an alternative. Does Mr. Putin respect Mr. Assad because of his vigilance, the impolite word is bloody mindedness? Does he get respect because of it?
Certainly, the public messaging from the Kremlin has always been that we're committed to quote unquote legitimate government in Damascus as opposed to Assad himself. But in practice, as you say, they really saw no alternative to him. So it really is Assad. But I don't think in private they respect him. Frankly, he let his country fall apart. But again, because they don't see alternatives to him, they remain committed. And the other interesting thing is here, unlike nowhere else in the region, Putin did choose a side. No matter how much the Kremlin tried and signaled to the region that they're committed to talking to everybody and so forth, de facto, they did choose a side, and that is also one difference in terms of how they approach the rest of the region.
You mentioned frozen conflicts when we were talking about parts of the Middle East. Certainly, there are frozen conflicts in the Caucasus as well, frozen conflicts in Eastern Europe, and that Russia is managing the frozen conflict of Syria. Does it have a vision of what it wants to achieve in this frozen conflict, or is it perpetual turmoil to draw enemies of the Kremlin in and compromise them? How do they see this going forward 5 or 10 years?
There seems to be a preference almost for a frozen conflict, because in a frozen conflict, as long as fighting is low and costs of being there are minimal, again, everybody needs Russia, and everybody's looking to Russia to provide some kind of interim solution. That's how frozen conflicts work in the post-Soviet space. It's basically kind of a belt of instability in the post-Soviet space that's almost extending deeper towards Syria and the Eastern Mediterranean. It does not seem that the Kremlin has any vision for Syria beyond really propping up Assad. And the fact of the matter is, it's a very kind of dark, cynical view of the world that is really, this is as good as it gets. This is all that there is. Recall in the beginning of the Syrian intervention, the way Russia approached its airstrikes was basically to put the world in front of a choice. It's either ISIS or Assad. And so there's no vision, no alternative for a better future.
And you mentioned that the Biden administration is still developing its policy. Does the Kremlin have expectations?
I think the Kremlin is expecting, I think it's reading the writing on the wall, and that is that Assad is headed towards normalization. And if anything, because of disagreements, it seems, within the Biden administration. The lack of policy is also, you know, an answer in and of itself. And I think the Kremlin is reading that as even less American interest in Syria, which allows the Russian vision to go forth. And lastly, you know, one thing I want to say is, if we think back to 2013, Ukraine happened a year after. We're now looking again at Russian troops amassed on the Ukrainian border, again, in a context where the Kremlin perceives weakness from the West. In this case, after the Afghanistan debacle, after the Biden administration lifted sanctions against Nord Stream 2. So whenever the Kremlin perceives weakness from the West, he tends to act, and it reverberates globally. So in other words, Syria and Ukraine very much go together. They did in 2013, and they do now as well.
Anna Porchevskaya, the author of the new book, Putin's War in Syria, Russian Foreign Policy and the Price of America's Absence. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.